Welcome back to Celluloid Jelly, a podcast featuring a couple of ex-video store guys who just love to talk about movies. I'm CJ Talbot, and joining me as always will be Cesar Alejandro Jr. from Filmsmash.com. For this episode, we discuss Mel Brooks' 1974 smash comedy hit, Young Frankenstein. All right, welcome back, everybody. Hey, Cesar, how are you?
I'm doing all right, CJ. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. You're throwing my whole game off. I don't usually have someone sitting next to me when I'm doing this.
Literally just sitting here.
we have a special guest for this particular episode. We're going to be talking about Young Frankenstein.
Who's our special guest, CJ? I'm here all the way in Baltimore.
I know Cesar is joining us from our Baltimore studio, and joining us here from our Southern California studio is Miss Chelsea Dove, a former co-worker of ours at Suncoast and White Marsh Mall. Hey, Chelsea.
Hello, CJ.
Hey, Chelsea.
Hi, Cesar. I'm much more enthusiastic about talking to Cesar.
Well, you get to talk to me every day.
I know. I know.
So, how's everything going, Cesar? Good?
Yeah, pretty good, I'd say. October tends to be a less busy month when it comes to the job. But I've been filling up a little bit of downtime with a lot more horror movie watching, which, you know, is typical of me in celebration of a Halloween.
Yeah, I know you take your 31 days of horror movies this time of the year very seriously.
Very seriously.
I, on the other hand, have not been able to watch a lot of horror movies. although in the last 10 days or so, I've probably watched 5 or 6 horror flicks. Yeah. So I've watched Lucio Fulci's Zombie 2.
Oh, yeah, I love that movie.
Yeah, one of the greats. It got that terrific zombie versus shark scene. And that's not even my favorite. My favorite is when the zombie pulls the wife's head onto, like, the spear goes right through her eye.
Yeah, the splinter.
Yeah, that's like, my favorite shot in any zombie movie. I love that.
It's a pretty great scene.
It is.
It's a pretty entertaining movie all around.
It's got this, God, I don't know how I want to describe it. Like a hypnotic score to it.
Yes.
It's just like, it's like a repeating tone throughout the entire movie. And it's, I don't know. It's really not that great a score, but for some reason I find myself, like, you know, entranced by it. So.
Yeah. I think a lot of Italian films, particularly genre films like horror or like Western, like there's a lot of, music that is pretty, that's become iconic, but it seems to fit the film pretty well. It's totally different from, like, music choice in, like, Hollywood productions, for instance.
Sure. Well, our next episode is going to be on The Thing. Yep. So I did take the time to rewatch that. We rewatched it together, didn't we?
I voted for that movie because I've been wanting to see it.
And so, yeah, one of the things that we'll definitely talk about next week is Ennio Morricone's score.
The Thing is a movie that tends to be on TV pretty frequently, like just flipping through channels. I probably haven't sat down and watched The Thing, John Carpenter's Thing, specifically, in probably 4 or 5 years. But it's a movie I love, and, you know, it's got no small cult following with it.
No, yeah. So we'll save that for next week. Miss Chelsea, anything you've watched recently that you want to talk about or recommend to our listeners? Don't be bashful.
I watch Hocus Pocus because that's one of my favorite Halloween movies, and I try to watch it once a year around this time, just because I love it, and I love Bette Midler in it. And then we watched It Follows after we watched The Thing, which was my first time seeing it, and I really liked it. I liked the concept of, like, something that just follows you. It doesn't run or anything. It just walks. I thought it was, like, really creepy. So I really enjoyed that movie.
Yeah, there's, I mean, for me personally, well, talk about another movie that has a great music score. It Follows definitely has that great sort of like synth 80s thing going on. Mm-hmm. A very John Carpenter-ish type score. But the persistence and inevitability of that catching up with you is the thing that is scary about that movie. Yeah.
So it's kind of like Pepe Le Pew.
It doesn't bounce up and down though with a giant beating heart though. So it just wants to crush your beating heart.
Okay.
Yeah, there's a movie. I mean, I haven't seen it. Follows yet. I mentioned it before. There's a movie I became interested in that had a seemingly interesting premise called It Stains the Sand Red or something similar to that.
Okay. Yeah, I've heard of that.
Yeah, well, you know, just reading the synopsis for it, it's about, like, I guess, you know, the existence of zombies has happened, and then there's, I guess, in the Las Vegas desert, a woman is on the run from a shambling zombie. Now, at first, you know, she's able to outrun it because, you know, it's a slow-moving, you know, dead thing. But as time goes on, you know, the zombie doesn't have to rest. It doesn't get fatigued. So it becomes like a drawn out chase across the desert as she's running for her life.
Yeah, that sounds like a great concept actually.
Yeah, it's a movie I only just got only just became aware of, but it's something that just conceptually really caught my interest, considering, you know, how pretty much almost everything's been done in zombie film already.
Yeah.
How about you, CJ? What have you watched recently? Anything you care to talk about?
No, we just talked about a couple movies. So I mean, I'm good. That's you know, I mentioned Zombie 2, and I also watched It Follows with Chelsea. So, okay. You know, I'm ready. I'm ready to talk about Young Frankenstein.
Okay. Before we get started, like, when was the last time you had sat down and watched Young Frankenstein in its entirety? Before, you know, reviewing it for the...
It's been a long time, but, you know, at Suncoast, we've had it on the playlist a couple of times. So, you know, I'm certainly familiar with the film. It's probably my favorite Mel Brooks movie, although I don't necessarily think it's the funniest one, but it's my favorite.
I feel the same way. Like, the last time I sat down and watched it was it last year that Gene Wilder passed away?
2 years ago.
2 years ago. When he passed away, I like did like a marathon of a couple of my favorite movies of his, and that is my favorite Mel Brooks movie, and I think probably it's my favorite Gene Wilder performance of the couple movies that I've seen of his, like Charlie and Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory and Blazing Saddles. I really like he reaches peak manic Gene Wilder in this movie, and I'm very fond of that. That performance
has some of my favorite lines of his entire career in this movie.
Same.
Yeah. This movie made me want to rewatch a bunch of other movies. Certainly Gene Wilder, you know, I mean, you know that I have an affinity for many of his other pictures, including Silver Streak, which is brilliant. But it also made me want to watch The Royal Tenenbaums. Because when Gene Hackman shows up as the blind man, like, I just want to rewatch all of Gene Hackman's, like, comedic performances. Because he's so good in it, and it's, at the time, it was so unexpected.
Mm-hmm. It makes me, okay, well, I guess we could save it for later, but we could talk about it later. But, like, it makes me wonder, like, exactly, because this movie takes place, you assume it's, like, present day, which would have been the 1970s.
Well, Gene Wilder mentions that it's the 20th century when he's talking to the inspector. There's a line, which I actually really, really like. He says, it's the 20th century, Inspector. Monsters are passé, like ghosts and goblins. I love that because, like, that was actually true at the time, like, in the 30s and 40s, monster movies like Dracula and Frankenstein and Creature from the Black Lagoon and things like that were sort of like the top tier of horror filmmaking. And by the 1970s, when this movie came out, Hollywood had sort of transitioned into the more real world psychopathic horror like Norman Bates and Psycho.
You know, You know, things like, well, not monster, but maybe more like religious in like Exorcist. Or,
yeah, that too, definitely.
You're the big horror films as its contemporaries.
Well, and The Exorcist was what? Only the year before Young Frankenstein came out, right? Young Frankenstein came out in 74. The Exorcist was 73, right?
I guess so.
Yeah.
I thought Young Frankenstein was a little bit later. Is it 73? Or 74, I'm sorry.
It's 74 for Young Frankenstein.
Yeah. I don't know why. In my mind, I always thought it was like a 76 picture.
Nope. And you're usually really good with dates, though. So, like, normally, if I wasn't 100% sure of this, like, I would take your word for it, but it is 74.
Okay, fine.
Hey, I tried to pay you a compliment in there, too. Like, usually you're way better with dates and names than I am. So, there you go.
Okay.
So, anyway, Miss Chelsea, would you like to tell us what Young Frankenstein is about?
You're putting me on the spot. You usually write, like, a nice little neat synopsis. I'm so
I'm putting you on the spot.
I'm so bad at giving plot summaries. Like, I'm just... I do, like, I go way over the top and give too much detail in my summaries, but...
Well, just keep it short and sweet.
Young Frankenstein is about the descendant of Victor Frankenstein, a famous doctor who brought dead tissue back to life and created a horrifying monster. And when his grandfather passes away, he has to go to Transylvania to settle his estate. And when he's there, he discovers the lab and the notes and figures out that it probably could work. So he tries to do it himself.
So he himself becomes obsessed with reanimation.
Yeah. And up until that point, he's like tried to distance himself from his grandfather's legacy because he thinks he's a cuckoo, I think is the term that he uses in the beginning scene, which is a great scene.
I love that scene. I love every scene, but I love that scene.
He actually pronounces his name as Frankenstein and not Frankenstein until about...
Right, as a way to further estrange himself from the family.
Until, like, the final hour when he, like, declares, it's pronounced Frankenstein, so...
Yep, so...
Summary.
Pretty good. All right, not bad. High five. There you go. Cesar, you asked when we had seen this movie last. What about you? When's the last time you watched Young Frankenstein?
Yeah, you know, when she mentioned, Chelsea mentioned that she watched it shortly after Gene Wilder had passed away. I think when he passed away, I ended up watching just Willy Wonka and Blazing Saddles, but I probably hadn't watched Young Frankenstein in probably 6 or 7 years, in its entirety. Like, yeah, you'd mentioned that, you know, we played it at Suncoast pretty frequently. So, yeah, I mean, that's something that had always been kind of like buzzing in my ears, but hadn't had a proper viewing for quite a while.
Well, you know, this is one of our old manager Dave Foster's favorite movies.
Hey, Dave.
What's up? So a little shout out to Dave. Dave would quote this movie all the time. Yeah, I mean, for real, all the time. Like, not just around Halloween. He would say, could be worse, could be raining all the time. if things got busy and hectic, especially around Christmas, and we were feeling overwhelmed by shipment and customers and things, he would always have a smile on his face, and he would say, could be worse, could be raining.
Learned a lot of good stuff from that guy.
Yeah, Dave's the man. We love you, Dave.
I'm going to be sure to tag him in a post, so, you know, as a hint to watch, to listen to this.
He'll listen. He's a fan.
This is one of my favorite movies, too. I think when I interviewed for you, and one of the interview questions, what's your favorite movie? And this was one of them. It has not changed.
I remember Monty Python and the Holy Grail, The Princess Bride, and Young Frankenstein.
Three favorite movies.
And we have watched all of them over the last year together, which is cool. Yeah. I don't think we watched any of my favorite movies this year.
You didn't watch Star Wars?
Is Jaws one of your favorite movies?
Yes, okay. Jaws is definitely one of my favorite movies. I was just giving her a hard time, that's all. That's what I do. So anyway, Cesar, is this one of your favorite Mel Brooks movies?
Yeah, probably number two.
Behind Blazing Saddles?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, Blazing Saddles is a little bit more outrageously funny, envelope pushing. As a kid growing up, I was a big Spaceballs fan, obviously being a big Star Wars fan. But that one hasn't held up as well for me. But for some reason, Young Frankenstein, you know, really, I don't know, that's the gold standard in Mel Brooks movies for me.
I think a lot of the, one of the main reasons for Young Frankenstein being able to hold up so well is because it's such a good send-up of, like, classic Hollywood era, like, horror films, that, like, you know, as a period, almost like a period, film, it doesn't have any, you know, I mean, like, Spaceballs, you know, people have, like, CRT monitors and, like, buttons and, like, weird little dials and stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, the sets never feel, they feel too open, like, too much like a stage. But Young Frankenstein, because, you know, that's basically how those movies were shot and done, you know, it looks just like, you know, like it could have been. And from what I understand, they used a handful of props from the 31 Frankenstein picture, too, yeah?
Mm-hmm. Yes. All of the original equipment for the Frankenstein lab was kept by a guy named Kenneth Strickfaden. Mel Brooks had tracked him down. It turns out that he had all that stuff just sitting in a garage packed up. And so they were able to sort of break it out and clean it up and set it back up. And they had him as a technical advisor and actually gave him a credit on the film as well. A special thank you. So that's the set of the actual laboratory is fantastic. And I love that era of what we thought of as like a mad scientist lab with like sort of like electricity everywhere. And there's just like a constant, the humming of electricity and, you know, the platform that goes, you know, up into the ceiling so that they can, you know, use lightning and, just, you know, and it's much more, it's much more of a physical, tactile type of place than what we actually use for laboratories right now.
Okay, what can you tell us about the background? I mean, you knew a bit about like the set and props and stuff. Any other interesting things? Like, where was this film shot? Was it on stage or on location in any places?
Well, I don't have that in my notes, but it was shot at the Fox lot in Hollywood. And the exterior of the European, like, village set was on the back lot at MGM.
I know that I was reading last night that the first studio that they went to, I can't remember what it was, didn't want to give Mel Brooks the budget that he wanted, and they didn't want him to shoot it in black and white. So he took it to 20th Century Fox, and they were like, yeah, you can shoot it in black and white. And that's why it ended up being a Fox picture, because they allowed him to shoot in black and white. Which was like a deal breaker.
My understanding was that the original budget was the main thing, and the black and white issue came up later. Columbia would not give them the money they wanted. You're absolutely right about that. So they took it over to 20th Century Fox, and Alan Ladd had just taken over the studio. Alan Ladd has been an important figure in 1970s. And 1980s blockbuster filmmaking. You know, he's the guy who greenlit George Lucas's Star Wars. He's the guy who, when he left 20th Century Fox, created his own company and funded Blade Runner. So, I mean, we've talked about Alan Ladd before. You know, he's one of those pivotal guys who believed in filmmakers and vision over what even he himself understood about films. But the black and white thing, I did listen to the commentary track with Mel Brooks, and he said that even once they got to Fox, they still had the conversation that they wanted him to shoot it in color. And then even once they said, okay, we'll release it in black and white, we want you to shoot it on color stock, though.
He was like, no way.
And he was like, no, because you'll screw me. Mm-hmm. You know, so we're definitely shooting it on black and white stock. So he won that battle, you know, and I think it's to Alan Ladd's credit that he, you know, gave him what he wanted. And thank God, because it's a gorgeous looking movie. And I mean, I love Gene Wilder, and I think Gene Wilder is both odd looking and handsome at the same time.
Yep.
But he was built by God or nature or whatever for black and white. He looks so amazing in this movie. And I will just a shout out to cinematographer Gerald Hirschfeld, who sort of recreated, you know, the look and feel of like those old 1930s horror films. They do a magnificent job. You know, aside from using a Panavision widescreen format for the film instead of the boxy Academy standard. You know, this easily could have been a movie made back in that time period.
I think the other interesting thing that I was reading about was Gene Wilder and Mel Brooks wrote the movie together, and Gene Wilder agreed to do it if Mel Brooks agreed not to appear in the film, because Gene Wilder felt that it was like ruin the feel or kind of like take the audience out of it. But Mel Brooks appears 3 times off screen. He's the wolf that howls in the their wolf scene.
And the cat.
He's the cat that screeches, and he's the voice of Victor's grandfather when they enter the lab and like hear his, I guess, his diary entry like being read over. There's a gargoyle at the end that's supposed to kind of look like Mel Brooks, but I didn't really notice it because it kind of happens really quickly. But
it could have just been Mel Brooks. He's kind of gargoyle-ish.
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah, just watch the 12 chairs. So, Cesar, do you have a particular favorite scene in Young Frankenstein?
I think my favorite scene is, I'm going to say, I have two answers here. Pretty much anything with Marty Feldman. In particular, I mean, we were just talking about Gene Wilder, but I really like the moment when, after they do the procedure, and it seems that the creature is not going to come to life, Gene Wilder kind of has his dignity and grace.
That's a great moment.
It is.
Made even better by the end, Marty Feldman looking at the camera. Quiet dignity and grace.
Nobody goes back and forth between complete calm and confidence and uproarious anger and rage than Gene Wilder.
Yep.
Nobody in the history of cinema. My favorite scene, it is basically after they reveal the monster. So once the monster comes out and strangles Gene Wilder, and they have like their little game of charades, which is just, it's really funny. Both Terry Garr and Marty Feldman are like brilliant in that scene.
Mm-hmm.
And then ending with, once they get the monster subdued with the sedative, Wilder calms down, sits, crosses his legs, has Marty Feldman sit down. They have this nice little conversation about where the brain came from, and then again he gets like super excited and starts to strangle Marty Feldman, who then starts a second game of charades. So like that sequence is my absolute favorite in the movie.
That's a really good one. I also like when they have towards the end of the film, when they have the creature locked up and he goes, "Do not let me out under any circumstance," and he goes in and the creature just sits up and he like turns around and goes, "Get me the hell out of here," and he like gradually builds up until he turns around and goes, "Hey, handsome."
Right.
And that's another good like building.
I love that too, because that whole line about, "Do you want to talk about the Olympian ideals?" is like one of my favorites too. You are a god. And Peter Boyle's great.
Mm-hmm.
Peter Boyle, one of the things that I had not thought of, because he looks like Frankenstein, or what we think of as Frankenstein. But one of the things Mel Brooks points out in the commentary track on the DVD, via 20th Century Fox Home Video, little plug there, is that he doesn't copy anything from Boris Karloff. Aside from the general look of the monster, Peter Boyle is completely doing something that is his own. And I think that that's a testament to both the writing by Wilder and Brooks, and then the performance of Peter Boyle, who's just great. It has like a childlike innocence to him.
I think that's a good point. To be honest, like I probably don't know Peter Boyle in too much stuff outside of this film. being completely honest with you, like before Young Frankenstein, what was he really known for?
He's had bit parts in a bunch of stuff.
The only thing I really know him from is that sitcom.
He was the father on Everybody Loves Raymond for many years, but not until he was an older man. I don't know. Hang on, I'll look it up real quick. I mean, the big one is he's the character of Wizard in Taxi Driver.
What year was Taxi Driver? Was
it was after Young Frankenstein?
Okay.
Let's see. Let's go back to the 70s. Hit our time machine and go back to the 70s.
Actually, you know, I pulled up his filmography too. You know, I guess you can't really forget that he was also in Kickboxer 2, The Road Back.
Oh, Friends of Eddie Coyle. He's really good in that. I love that movie.
I've not seen that picture.
Oh, the movie's so good. You need to watch. It's a Criterion now. For past couple of years, I think it's been a Criterion.
Yeah.
He's in Fist with Stallone. He's in a pretty good heist flick called The Brinks Job with Peter Falk. I've seen that. It's good.
Is he more of a television actor than a film guy?
I mean, not until you get into, like, the 90s, when Everybody Loves Raymond. But William Friedkin directed The Brinks Job. Pretty good.
Cool.
So yeah, Peter Buell, he's been around.
Eddie Coyle is one I've been wanting to watch.
Well, maybe we should do an upcoming episode on that, because I would love to rewatch that. That's a really good flick.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, really sort of like understated, cool American 70s crime movie.
You can use your choice for it.
Maybe I will. You could use your choice for it. But anyway, back to Peter Boyle. Even without makeup, he looks like the fucking Frankenstein monster, though. I mean, like, he looks like a sweet man, but, like, they didn't really... There's, like, a little bit of, like, an accentuated forehead. And maybe a little bit on the cheekbones. But they're not doing a whole lot to his look aside from, like, adding the zippers and stuff onto his neck. Which is fine, because I love that Madeline Kahn actually calls him Zipper Neck, like, after they make love. After he gives it to her. And she finds the sweet mystery of life.
Since you mentioned Madeline Kahn.
Yeah, let's talk about Madeline Kahn for a second.
I love her in everything that I've ever seen her in. I think she's a brilliant comedic actress. I love her in Clue and in Blazing Saddles. And I absolutely adore her in this movie.
Yeah,
she's so funny.
Clue is one of those things where, like, the whole flames thing became, like, an internet meme. And that's always been one of my favorite, like, moments in Clue.
That's my favorite line in Clue, period.
And it's funny because, like, it's... What was that?
Yeah, her flames speech. Yeah, that's for me. When I think of Clue, that's immediately the first line I think of.
Mm-hmm.
That scene.
Not for me. For me, it's by now she was dead. When Wadsworth is laying lifeless on the kitchen floor and then just opens his eyes, like, that's my favorite moment.
Maybe we need. I just watched Clue earlier this year too. So
we watched Clue. Earlier this year also.
Clue's a perennial favorite for me. I absolutely love that movie. I think it's solid comedy filmmaking, and it's got great performances, and it's got one of Tim Curry's great performances. I wouldn't go so far as to say it's his best, because, you know, he's iconic in a number of roles, but that's probably my favorite Tim Curry performance. But yeah, Madeline Kahn is great in that, and she's terrific in Young Frankenstein. And, you know, like, her dynamic with Gene Wilder's Freddy is that obviously they are engaged to be married, and he is hot for her, visibly hot and ready to go at any moment when she's around. And yet, like, she's very sort of, like, not cold, but, like, you know, she doesn't, like, the scene at the train station, she doesn't want him to kiss her because he'll mess up her makeup. And
doesn't
want
to hold
lipstick.
Her hand because of her nails.
Right.
Taffeta.
Right. The taffeta dress will get ruined if he hugs her too or embraces her too closely. So they end up, like, what did they do? Like, they bash
elbows. Yeah.
No, which is funny. And that continues later in the bedroom scene with, like, the no tongues thing.
Yeah.
You know?
Which I heard was improvised.
By her, yeah. Yeah, and that's a great line.
And just to talk about, because this was one of two movies that Mel Brooks turned into a musical. And in the original Broadway cast, Madeline Kahn's character, Elizabeth, was played by Megan Mullally. And I think that is a perfect choice because she's another crazy hysterical female who I really like watching on stage and on screen. So
yeah.
I think for that role to be picked up by another female, Megan Mullally was like a perfect choice for the stage version that they did.
It's funny because in the movie, like, we almost forget that Khan's in the film.
Mm-hmm.
Because she shows up in the train station scene, which is like the third scene in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And then she's gone for almost an hour.
Yeah.
And so when she pops back up after Terry Garr's Inga character and Freddie have sex, Cloris Leachman, who we have to talk about too, but Cloris Leachman comes down to find them and she's like, maybe you should put on a tie. Is that the line?
Yeah.
Yeah. Like your fiance is here. Maybe you should put on a tie. You know, once we get Madeline Kahn back into it, like, she's got a handful of good scenes, like, right in a row.
Mm-hmm.
Like, her arrival scene and with Marty Feldman. Like, Feldman's hilarious in that scene and the way he, like bites her.
Mink.
In mink, yeah.
Yeah.
That's hilarious.
The Groucho Marx impersonation.
Yeah. He does his best Groucho, which is hilarious. Feldman's one of those guys, though, like, because he has such a distinctive appearance, I think his acting ability and his timing often is overshadowed by just the look. Like, I can imagine directors going, get me a Marty Feldman for this role, you know. But Feldman, you know, he and Terry Garr and Gene Wilder are a real team in this movie. Mm-hmm. And I don't think the movie works without any one of them. Yeah, I mean, obviously Gene Wilder is the star and he is one of the greatest comedic actors of all time, I think. But Terry Garr brings something that probably no one else could have to that role. And Marty Feldman brings something that no one else could have. And you could have cast a different guy as the Hunchback without the, you know, the condition that Marty Feldman has with his eyes, and it probably would have been almost as funny.
You wouldn't have got the hump joke, though, because he was moving it around on set, and so they wrote it into the movie, and I think that's one of the best, like, sight gags in the whole movie, is his hump keeps moving back and forth throughout the film.
Yeah, so I really appreciate, like, the performance that he gives and his reaction shots and the timing and the way that he works with the other actors. That was Cesar talking. What'd you say, Cesar?
I didn't say anything. I think that was you.
It was an echo.
Oh. Okay.
I'm not sure.
Echo, echo, echo. Now pinch hitting Manny Mota. Anybody get that reference?
No.
Somebody will. Somebody, I'm going to leave that in. Somebody will get that reference.
Oh, yeah? Okay.
I cannot believe you don't get that. Oh, you haven't seen that movie.
Oh, is
you
that
have.
Out?
No, it's not. It's Airplane.
I still can't believe you've never seen Airplane.
Well, at this point, I'm committed to this bit.
I think at this point, I'm just going to make sure that Airplane's one of my picks. So that you have to watch it.
I'm going
to
make sure Airplane's one of my vetoes.
It's so good. Airplane's so good.
We should keep up this dynamic for as long as we can, CJ.
Look, you have to pick one. You have to either watch Wrath of Khan or Airplane.
I guess it's going to be Airplane then.
Airplane.
Okay, I'm okay with that because Airplane is so fucking good. You'll love it. It's so funny.
If you're going to use this one of your picks, I'm going to accidentally watch Airport instead.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, that would probably be a really great conversation because we probably wouldn't realize you hadn't watched Airplane for at least 20 minutes.
George Kennedy.
You know what's funny? Because, like, yeah, if you start talking about George Kennedy, I'm gonna think that you're accidentally talking about Naked Gun instead of Airplane. But I wouldn't necessarily guess that you've been watching Airport.
O.J. Simpson.
Right. It took on a whole new meaning 20 years after that.
Yeah, no kidding.
All right, so what else? Come on, Cesar. I feel like we've been monopolizing the conversation. Get in here. Jump in. The water's warm.
You two are definitely the experts. I think you guys have probably watched this film quite a bit more than I have. I really like Kenneth Mars as Inspector Kemp.
He's great.
He's kind of like the Clockwork Ratchet arm man.
My favorite moment with him is at the end when they pull his arm off and he just goes, "Oh shit." And then hoist it into the air.
I totally thought that you were going to mention the monocle over the eye patch.
Oh, yeah. I absolutely.
My favorite moment with him, definitely.
Which moment? The arm?
No, the monocle.
Oh, yeah. The monocle over the eye patch is hysterical.
I love the scene where they're playing darts and he cheats at darts. Like, what a fucking asshole.
And he's got, you know, he's like, he got something in his Darth Vader chest that makes it sound like he's throwing darts.
Yeah, to be honest, like, his character, like, I think there's a bit of an ode to, like, Dr. Strangelove in that a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Not, you know, maybe not a lot, but, like, you know, just, like, the way that Dr. Strangelove can't control his arm, I think that's, like, Kenneth Mars, like, mm-hmm. doing a little bit of that.
Yeah.
Like, his accent's so heavy that the other villagers can't understand what he's saying.
Footsteps, what? Footsteps, footsteps, footsteps. I love it.
And you mentioned Gene Hackman. I love that scene. I really love that scene. I think it's absolutely hysterical.
That scene's great. Yeah, like we didn't really dig into during Blade Runner the Frankenstein thing between Roy Batty and Joe Turkel's character Tyrell. But the scene where Frankenstein's monster sort of like has his quiet moments with the blind man, both in the original and in Young Frankenstein, that type of a scene, they translated into Blade Runner, and basically, like, the Roy Batty and the Pris character sort of, like, hang out with the J.F. Sebastian character and take refuge with him before moving on to the next phase of the film. So, like, that's something that structurally they took from Frankenstein and put it into Blade Runner. And of course Mel Brooks and Gene Wilder write that into this film and do it brilliantly. And Gene Hackman was apparently just a tennis buddy of Gene Wilder's. And just, you know, the way Gene Wilder tells the story, Hackman was like, "Oh, you know, I've never done comedy. You know, I love comedy. Do you have a little bit part for me?" And Wilder said that he wasn't talking about a significant part like the blind man. He was talking about just being like a policeman off to the side of the frame, you know, just to kind of be on set for a day. And so, you know, once he got together with Mel Brooks, they thought it would be perfect to have him come and play the blind man. And thank God, because that's a terrific scene. The espresso line was an ad lib and it cracked the crew up like
that's
crazy.
That's why it fades to black.
Yeah.
And yeah, I read that as well. It's another great improv line.
Yeah. And like I said earlier, like just watching Hackman in that movie, like made me want to go back and rewatch Hackman's other comedy performances. Cause he's really, really good.
Yeah. You know, at the time of the movie, like you mentioned, he hadn't really been in a comedy before, but he was probably one of the biggest stars in the world at the time, considering his run of films.
Well, after Bonnie and Clyde and the what was it? Was it 1971 for The French Connection?
Yeah, 71. I'm pretty sure.
Yeah. So like, yeah, Gene Hackman was a huge star, but apparently a lot of audience members didn't know that it was him.
Oh yeah.
And he originally was uncredited,
mm-hmm.
But subsequent video releases have actually included him as the blind man in the end credits.
I think typically I always see him like listed towards the end of any credits list when talking about the cast for this film.
Yeah.
We haven't really talked about Cloris Leachman.
Cloris Leachman's great. Go. Go for it.
I love her Frau Blücher. You should have queued up Winnie Morris, Winnie. But I think my favorite moment of hers, I think the Ovaltine scene is great, which I heard was another ad-libbed moment by her. But I love when she's playing the violin and walking backwards up the steps. And she's going, yes, yes, he was my boyfriend. Like, I love that line so much.
She's great because she's such a physically gifted performer.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just her line deliveries and her accent and her expression, but like her entire body is involved in every bit of this performance.
Mm-hmm.
So like when she's playing the violin, she's also walking back and forth up the steps as she does mm-hmm. it. And she uses very exaggerated movements.
Mm-hmm.
And in earlier in the scene, the Ovaltine scene, and I love Gene Wilder's reaction to her when he finally just has had enough. But like every time she keeps coming back to him, the way her body moves, it's really great. It's almost like she's like riding a wave backwards to him. It's so like sort of soft and gradual that she kind of like turns and moves backwards. It's not just turning the head and asking a question. She gets her whole like frame into it.
Mm-hmm.
So like she's brilliant, you know, and she's you know, a great addition to this particular cast. And she's been in a bunch of other Mel Brooks movies, but mm-hmm. You know, she's not somebody that that people of this generation probably know a whole lot about. Mm-hmm. They probably don't even know the name Cloris Leachman, which is sad.
I feel like doesn't she have a TV show or something on Netflix, or am I thinking about something else?
Is she even alive?
Cloris Leachman?
Yeah.
I know, like, she was on one of the first seasons of Dancing with the Stars, and she, all of her dances are very kind of odd and weird.
Very Cloris Leachman-like.
Yeah.
I don't know. Is she?
No, she's alive.
Is she alive?
She's in pre-production for The Croods 2. She was in the TV series American Gods that just came out based on the Neil Gaiman book. And there was a TV show called Clarence where she played Cloris. So I guess she
does a lot of voiceover work, it looks like. She's in The Iron Giant, and she's in the American voice cast for Castle in the Sky. And
She's in an episode of Bob's Burgers.
Wow, one of your favorites.
Chelsea's
Bob Burgers crazy.
Oh, she's in a newer episode that I literally just watched a couple weeks ago where she plays an old woman at a retirement home that Tina goes to and tries to help make her happy. And she's actually very funny. I didn't know that was Cloris Leachman. That's awesome.
In a retirement home.
Bob's Burgers.
She's also in, you know, one of the great landmark film noirs of the 1950s, Kiss Me Deadly. She's the woman at the beginning that is standing in the middle of the road that Mike Hammer almost flips his car trying to avoid. Yeah, we watched that.
We did.
Yeah. I made her watch it.
I think it took me 2 tries because I fell asleep the first time.
Okay, let's address this. You need to stop laying down when you watch movies. If you sit up, you won't fall asleep.
That's because we only watch movies after midnight. And
well,
I get up.
That's when I get home from work.
Well, I get up at, you know, 6:30 in the morning. So by midnight, I'm tired.
Not every day.
Most days.
And you still haven't seen the end of Blade Runner. Okay, which is why you weren't on the Blade Runner podcast. Okay.
I can guess at the ending.
The ending's like the best part.
Yeah, I was listening to your Blade Runner podcast. The what's the speech? The
Tears and Rain.
Yeah, I've never heard it because I keep falling asleep.
All right, we're getting sidetracked now.
Well, I don't know. I think you know, Young Frankenstein. To be completely honest, I feel like this episode is basically just a love fest for it.
I fell asleep the first night we watched Young Frankenstein. I had to watch it a second time.
I wasn't going to mention that. I'm glad you're owning up to it.
I did. I was tired. And it's one of my favorite movies, and I fell asleep.
You have to own your behavior.
I know. I do.
We did not talk about the putting on the Ritz scene. Let's do that.
Oh, that's a great That's a great scene.
Well, you know,
and turned into a full-fledged tap number in the musical, yeah. Which is very fitting. But that is a great scene.
That's a scene that almost got cut at the script stage. Wilder wrote the scene. Mel Brooks thought it was a little bit too much. Apparently it's, you know, one of the only real fights they had.
Is that the fight where, like, Mel Brooks, like, stormed out of his apartment and then called him and was like, why would you let a madman into your apartment? And that was, like, his way of apologizing?
I don't know. That IMBD story is out of context and it doesn't say, so yeah. I'm not sure. But the way Mel Brooks tells it, and the way Gene Wilder tells it is very similar in fact that, that I would say that's probably not the one. But, you know, apparently, you know, Gene Wilder, you know, was very hurt and very angry that Mel Brooks didn't want to include this scene. Gene Wilder thought that it was important to not only the story, but to the character. And he fought very hard for it. And right in the middle of the argument, Brooks was like, all right, it's in. And Gene Wilder was stunned. And he was like, what do you mean? And he's like, well, I wasn't sure. I had to know that you were sure. So if you're fighting this hard for it, it's in. You know, and that's
thank goodness it's one of the best scenes.
Yeah, I mean, and that's you know, some real insight into the process. You know, and you know, apparently their original cut of Young Frankenstein was almost twice as long as the final cut, and they just kept cutting bits out that didn't work. So there's a lot of stuff that even isn't on the DVD outtakes. But, you know, thankfully, you know, things like the putting on the Ritz scene and the walk this way scene got included, and they were originally going to be cut out. Mm-hmm. I like Gene Wilder dancing and singing. It reminds me of Willy Wonka. So, you know, it makes me want to rewatch that movie.
Mm-hmm.
And Peter Boyle's hilarious. So
are there any, is there anything in this film that you felt could have been done better? Or, like, do you have any critiques about the movie?
Not necessarily. I would say the one thing that I guess I could understand if someone thought it was a little slow.
Mm-hmm.
Because even Mel Brooks's later movies, if you look at stuff like Robin Hood Men in Tights and Dracula Dead and Loving It and even Spaceballs, the pacing's much quicker. But the pacing of this, I feel like, kind of like fits in with the aesthetic of the homage that they're doing to Frankenstein, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, and, mm-hmm. and the James Whale movies. So I feel like it fits, but I can understand if people are like, eh, you know.
Yeah. I agree with you. I think the pacing in a movie, it's probably a little bit of both, you know, trying to be true to, like, the tone of the films it's paying homage to.
Yeah.
Also, you know, I guess, like, this is a little bit... I mean, like, the producers, I also feel, is a little bit slower, so that could also be, you know, the filmmaking style at the time.
Sure. Even Blazing Saddles is not, like, a joke every 2 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's probably his funniest movie. Definitely his funniest movie, actually. I just want to give a shout-out to, what's the guy's name? Andrew Adamson and Mike Myers for ruining every angry mob scene with Shrek. Because every time an angry mob shows up on screen, I think about Shrek saying, oh, get your put the... I can't even do the line. Get your torches and pitchforks out. Ah. Right?
I didn't have that thought at all watching the movie.
I don't know. I always do. Anytime there's an angry mob scene, I now think of Shrek. So, you know.
I think that sounds like a personal problem.
Thanks, Mike Myers.
You think about Shrek? I always think about, like, Holy Grail.
Yeah, that's nice.
I can't, you know, Shrek was such a huge movie. I can barely tell you any joke in that entire film. That entire film series.
Ogres are like onions. Good, like that we used to, Shrek 2 we used to play in the store, and like Gordy and I used to like joke about it because I think Gordy likes those movies,
our good buddy Gordy. Yeah. Shrek 2 he would always say every time we played it, Shrek 2 is definitely the best Shrek movie ever.
It is. I will
in his
him.
Most emphatic arm movements possible. Like, Shrek 2 is just the best one.
Yeah.
Yeah. Love Gordy. Miss you, Gordy. If you're listening. You and Gordy did an escape room recently with some of our friends from the East Coast, right?
Yeah, Gordy, AC, Jordan, and I.
Yeah, and you got it out with 1 second left. Is that right?
Yes.
That's amazing.
I think there, you know, in retrospect, we should have been out quite a bit earlier, but there was definitely some.
Hey,
there was some heavy fooling around.
Hindsight's always 20/20, my friend.
Yes. But yeah, it was fun.
Cool. Do you have a favorite quote or moment from Young Frankenstein, Cesar?
Oh, it's definitely accepting your failures with grace and dignity.
Okay.
what's your favorite? Well, that one, and like we mentioned earlier, but the scene with Marty Feldman and Madeline Kahn,
where he's like act normal, say nothing, or something like that.
Yeah.
Where he does the Groucho Marx.
Yeah, that's at the end of that scene though. But yeah. Like I love it when like Freddie walks away from the car and Marty Feldman's Igor like walks right in and says the exact same lines that Freddie said, yeah. But somehow he seems just so much more desperate and sleazy about the whole thing. And as sex crazed as Freddie seems, Igor seems even more so.
Yeah, I mean, he's like, you know, what's that line when he walks in, when he's carrying the luggage? He goes like,
"If you need any help with the girls,
help with the girls."
Well, I love the "You take the blonde, I'll take the one in the toy bin." Yep.
I think my favorite Marty Feldman moment is when they walk into the lab and he points out the switches, and the first Gene Wilder throws the first one and it kind of sparks and he goes, "Damn your eyes," and Marty Feldman just points at his eyes and goes, "Too late." I think that's my favorite Marty Feldman moment.
Apparently he had a very good sense of humor about his I don't know if you call it a physical defect, but mm-hmm. his abnormality, you know? He was abnormal.
Which is another great scene.
Oh, which the brain that he's supposed to get for Dr. Hans Delbruck. Apparently, Brooks chose that name because it sounded like his own name, Hans Delbruck, Mel Brooks. Mm. So, and the brain depository thing, like I think that's very funny. Where it says like after 5 p.m., slip brains through the slot in the door. You know, just like a VHS tape at your local Blockbuster. I'm showing my age by using that reference.
It's definitely from the 70s then.
Yeah, yeah. Well, in 1974 though, like there were no Blockbusters. So like I assume putting something through a like slot in the door was still like a regular sort of like neighborhood business type thing.
Library.
Yeah, library or but like when I go to the auto mechanic and you drop your car in at night, there's a slot for you to throw your keys in and stuff like that. So, you know, I think, you know, I'm sure hardware stores have like little delivery slots and things like that. So, you know.
Great repositories.
Back when America was great.
Well, that was Transylvania, though.
Before we digitized everything and, you know, put a madman in the White House.
Oh, man.
Let's pivot back.
I think one of my favorite scenes, other than like the big ones that we've mentioned, like the Abby Normal and the Hey Handsome, I really like the scene where they're eating dinner after the experiment has failed, and
you haven't tasted your food.
Yeah, that is one of my favorite jokes in the whole movie. When she says, "You haven't even touched your food," and he just like slams his hands in the food and goes, "There, I've touched it. Are you happy?"
But he changes mood so quickly. Like immediately after that, he's like, "Oh, maybe it's better dead." And he sort of calms down and then he begins to eat his dinner like normal.
Yeah. And then in the dessert scene immediately after that, when the creature has woken up and is
right.
groaning, and you just made a yummy sound. I love that. I love the yummy sound bit.
Yeah,
yummy sound's a pretty great Pretty great line.
Yeah.
One of the things that I noticed about Terry Garr's performance is that Mel Brooks oftentimes used her to either, like, sort of, like, lead the audience in a way. It's like her reaction shots are often, I don't know how to describe it, but I'll give you an example. In the scene where Marty Feldman is on the roof and she and Gene Wilder are down and he's saying, you know, there's the chance of electrocution, and he starts to scream it. And Marty Feldman just appears next to him and he's like, why are you shouting? And Terry Garr, like, Gene Wilder looks at Marty Feldman. Terry Garr looks up at the ceiling. And so, like, immediately as an audience member, you're like, hey, wait a minute. You know, like, she leads us. Like, mm-hmm. You know, it's almost planned so that we see her look up, and then we're like, hey, how'd he get down there so fast? And they do that a handful of times with her particular character, and I think that that's a brilliant use of her.
A couple minutes after that scene when he says to her, elevate me, and I love her.
That seems great. To that. Apparently Gene Wilder was, you know, such a sensitive guy that he had difficulty in the scene where she's like kissing his fingers and stuff like that in mm-hmm. that scene. Mel Brooks even I can't remember if it was in a behind the scenes on the DVD or if it was in the commentary track, but he mentions that Wilder really had a thing for Terry Garr a little bit, and that maybe there had been something there for a little while, but that he didn't want to go into detail. Mm. So I guess before Gilda, there was Terry.
I mean, Terry Garr is pretty cute in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
She's really, and Mel Brooks also points out that in the scene where they recapture the beast, the three of them, when Gene Wilder's playing the violin,
mm-hmm.
Terry Garr is dressed like Sonya Henie from Thin Ice, which is kind of cool. Just a little nod to, I guess, one of his favorites. I was just about to say something, but now I forgot. We went off topic. Oh!
What else?
Well, this is not what I was going to say, but when they bring the monster to life, I was surprised to find out that the shot with the monster's head glowing was not, it was a fake head with a light inside. They actually took like a cast of Peter Boyle and they created like a hollow head and they painted it up and everything. And then they put a light and some fake teeth and stuff inside and they just put it on a dimmer and went back and forth so it would glow. And it's such a great looking fake head that I thought they probably animated the glow over his face. Oh, there's another echo. Hopefully that won't be a problem with us. Every time it echoes, I think that Cesar is trying to say something. But in any case, I was surprised to find out that it was a fake head and that they were using a light on a dimmer inside of it as opposed to something else. Because usually you can spot a fake head a mile away, and I couldn't. Like, it's a really great fake head. Go Cesar.
I don't know if I really have anything else to add. I mean, no, not really.
Quiet dignity and grace. That's
you're
you.
You're not going to get an explosion of emotion out of me.
Son of a bitch bastard, what did you do to me? What did you do to me?
Gene Wilder did it better.
Gene Wilder can do anything I can do better. He could do this podcast better. And he's dead. what I was going to say earlier when I kind of lost my train of thought was that the little gag that they do with when they first get the corpse and the coffin falls in the street and breaks open and the constable comes in and Gene Wilder uses the corpse's arm as his own and does the whole scene like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really funny scene, but he reused that gag in a movie that he directed called Haunted Honeymoon with Gilda Radner and Dom DeLuise. And in the Haunted Honeymoon, Instead of using an arm, he uses the lower half of a body. So he's got like a corpse's legs, like over, it, I think it's a horse stable or something. It's like over the horse stable and he's behind it. And, the legs have like a life of our own or life of their own. And so Gene Wilder has to sort of like react to what the legs are doing in that scene. And it's really funny. So I don't think Haunted Honeymoon is a great film, but it has its moments. So if anybody out there wants to give it a shot, I give you a soft recommendation on it. So Wilder was apparently he had always had an interest in directing himself, mm-hmm. and he directed either 4 or 5 movies, mm-hmm. and wrote a handful of other movies too, including The Woman in Red, which he starred in. Mm-hmm.
Never seen that one.
Yeah.
Or Haunted Honeymoon.
I've never seen, he did a movie right after Young Frankenstein called The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes' Smarter Brother. Mm-hmm. And it had not been available on home video for a really, really long time. But it came out a few years ago, and for whatever reason, I just haven't caught up with it. Mm-hmm. But it looks pretty funny. You ever seen that one, Cesar?
No. Actually, you know, I own a copy of it, but I haven't sat and watched it yet.
Well, you have to let me know if you recommend it after you watch it, because I'm interested.
I gotta tell you, I just have a huge pile of stuff that is just unwatched right now.
I believe it.
I'll be inspired, I'm sure.
Well, you've been on a pretty good roll this month. So I've noticed you always post on Facebook, you know, after you watch something, and you're keeping a running tally for the year, and you've gone from like the 150s to the 170s already this month.
Yeah. I think I'm at a pretty good pace, so not gonna do the 365 movies in a year, but I'm hoping to at least hit 200, which I think is very doable.
It gets tougher every year, especially as television gets better. You know, like I used to not watch any TV, and you know, this year we rewatched every season of Game of Thrones. I rewatched all of Twin Peaks, and I've only got 2 episodes left of the new Twin Peaks: The Return, which I'll watch this week.
And Stranger Things comes out this weekend. I'll definitely be watching that.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll pound through that over the weekend.
Yeah, probably.
I tend to take my time with a lot of the Netflix series. Like, I still haven't finished Defenders. I still have 2 episodes left.
I have not watched Luke Cage, Iron Fist, or The Defenders. I'm really behind on those.
What I have been watching is I've been watching Japanese, like, variety shows.
You told me that, yeah.
And, you know, I watched this one that was, it was not like a comedy, like not a variety show where they do like pranks or whatever, but it was, I can't remember what it was called, but I think it was just like a special where basically they talk to like little kids, and like their fathers work abroad. You know, whether like, for instance, there's this one episode where the father works in Vietnam and he's been living there for 4 years separate from his wife and daughter. But his daughter, like, you know, really misses him, and she's going to be entering middle school. And in Japan, that's the time when you start wearing a school uniform. So she's like 11 or 12 or something. And, I guess like the show, they basically organize a visit for her to go to Vietnam. But like the mother gives her information, like where her father works. And, you know, she goes, she flies over by herself with the film crew just watching her. And she has to do stuff like talk to Vietnamese like cab drivers and to get her where she needs to go. And she explores a little bit, but like, I was really surprised at how like kind of moving it was, because yeah. You know, this little girl is all, you know, all adventurous. She seems very outgoing, but when she finally appears in front of her dad, she turns like really shy. And she asks dad, you know, are you going to cry? And dad's like, no, I would never cry in front of you. But then later on, she wears her uniform and he realizes how much older she's gotten since he last saw her. And like his face like really starts to well up. And I remember thinking, wow, that's this drama, this human drama is really good.
Nice.
Mm-hmm. It was really sweet.
That sounds very sweet.
Cool. Well, we're going to wrap this up then. Is that cool? You have anything else you want to put a button on Young Frankenstein? Obviously, I think all 3 of us would recommend it to anyone out there who hasn't seen it. You know, But
well, I know I'm not certain if this episode will make it out before Halloween, but it's a movie that's perfect to watch any time of the year. I think it's terrific classic 70s comedy, and Gene Wilder, he's top of his game in this film. There's any number of quotes that totally memorable, and you can use in any situation. So it's a great one to remember for to keep in handy for your movie loving friends. Young Frankenstein's a classic.
Yeah, man, it's a good movie to watch, with a group of people too. So you can have a good time. So, and it certainly helps if you have an appreciation for the older, Universal Monsters films, but you don't have to. If you've never seen them, it's a completely self-contained story. It's really, I meant to mention this earlier, but it's much less a spoof and more of, a comedy sequel.
Mm-hmm.
There's a scene when, I guess the villagers are having, their meeting. It's a scene where they introduce Inspector Kemp, but, I guess whoever the elder with the gavel, who's in charge of keeping the meeting in order, he says, we've dealt with this 5 times before,
right?
So that must be a reference to the previous Frankenstein Universal films.
It absolutely is. I had that in my notes. Yep.
Son of Frankenstein.
Ghost of Frankenstein.
I don't know what the fifth one is.
I don't remember. To be honest, I haven't seen them all. I've seen the original Frankenstein and Bride of Frankenstein both a couple of times. To be honest, I think Bride of Frankenstein is probably one of the best sequels ever made.
I'd agree with you there. I like Bride of Frankenstein better than the original Frankenstein.
I agree, yeah. But yeah, Ghost of Frankenstein and Son of Frankenstein, I've never seen any of those. So not that I know of. I mean, maybe on TV as a kid or something like that, but not to where I could talk intelligently about them. So not that I talk intelligently about anything, but that's okay. That's a whole different story.
There it is.
That's self-effacing humor that everyone loves. Miss Chelsea, you have anything you want to add?
No.
Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's one of my favorite movies, so.
I know.
Could talk about it all day.
Well, you'll have to come back and join us again on a future episode.
If you ever do Monty Python and the Holy Grail, that's another one of my favorites.
If we ever do The Princess Bride or Monty Python and the Holy Grail, you are in.
Yeah. I mean, I like other movies too, but those are my favorites.
Chelsea's a huge Disney fan, so Disney animation Disney. And a lot of the Disney live action films as well. That's one of her areas of specialty.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty excited to talk about Cool Runnings.
I actually don't know if I've ever seen it. I think I watched it once as a kid, when they aired it on Disney Channel, but I don't think I've seen it since I was very young. Hocus Pocus for me.
Hocus Pocus times 10.
CJ's never seen Hocus Pocus.
I've never seen
I don't
Cool
know if
Runnings.
He will ever watch
I've never
it.
Seen Hocus Pocus either.
It's a classic.
It's a guy thing, see?
It's a Disney classic.
Guys don't watch Hocus Pocus because we don't like Bette Midler or Sarah Jessica Parker.
My dad likes Sarah Jessica Parker.
Good for him.
Or no, is it Jennifer Aniston? One of those two.
I think it's probably Jennifer Aniston. It's a big difference there.
Yeah, but Hocus Pocus is a great Halloween movie.
For kids.
No. Whatever.
It's a great Halloween movie for kids. So put that on right after The Halloween Tree or Halloween Town or Charlie Brown's
Halloween Town
Great Pumpkin.
No, but if you guys ever do Up, that's another one of my favorites.
I know it
is. Up
is
yeah. my favorite Pixar movie. And I'm looking forward to seeing Coco, Pixar's new movie. It comes out November.
You mean Book of Life Pixar?
Yeah, the Book of Life Pixar movie. But I think it looks good.
It does look good. Pixar movies are very solid, and they're reliably entertaining.
Except for Cars 2.
I love Cars 2.
I watched Cars 2 for the first time earlier this year. It's a pretty good movie.
See? Look at that. Outvoted.
Maybe it's because I don't generally like the Cars movies as a whole. I'm just not as into them as most people.
The third one didn't do as much for me because it felt like they were retreading a little bit of ground from the first one. Mm-hmm. But I think the first one's very soulful.
I like Cars Land.
And I like the second one.
At Disneyland, but I just don't like the Cars movies.
If people don't like the Cars movies, fine. I'm okay with that. It's, you know, but I don't think people need to go around trashing them. Like, every 5 seconds I hear in any Pixar conversation, except for the Cars movies, or, but the Cars movies suck.
You know? I don't think
or the
they
Cars
suck.
Movies
just
are
not,
just a cash-in.
They're just not like, my thing.
Yeah.
But I just don't like, I'm not
kids
into
love
Cars
that, and it
in
sells
general.
Disney a shit ton, $1 billion of merchandise they sell
they have a
on
whole
Cars movies.
Section of their theme park dedicated to Cars. Yeah. And it's really cool. I just am not as into the movies as some people.
Did we go into Cars?
We did the Cars ride, dude.
That's right. We raced, right?
Yeah.
Yeah,
but,
you and your mom, and then I was in a different car.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Because the line for that ride is
always
so long.
Little shout out
so
to Rhonda
long.
Dove there.
The line for that ride.
Cesar, when are you going to come out to California?
Please soon.
Are you going to come out and visit us?
It's a matter about, I guess it's a matter about money. So probably not until next year sometime. When would be a good time?
Summer.
any time you want, buddy. That's a good time.
If you
want
to see me, summer or spring break.
Well, you should come out for the summertime and see like a big movie out here. We'll go to LA and see something at like the Arclight or something.
I want to watch like a shitty movie. Like, are there like?
We can do that too, but we can do that anywhere. You don't want to go see a shitty movie at a great theater.
I want to watch. Sure, I do. I want to watch like you know, the Street Fighter and Sister Street Fighter at a theater. That's what I want to watch.
Well, we'll see what the new Beverly's playing on 35 when you come out.
I'm sure it'll be something worth it, whatever it is.
You'll be with us, so of course it'll be worth it.
It'll be worth it on screen, as opposed to at my sides.
It'll be a memorable experience either way, just like every podcast we do.
Yep. I'm holding this close to my heart.
Good.
Definitely come out soon. We miss you, so...
Yeah, I definitely want to.
Yeah.
I was going to watch, speaking of crappy movies, I was going to watch the Senators playing a Sonny Chiba movie.
I noticed that. I still get their emails and stuff.
Yeah, but I hadn't realized that today is actually my mother's birthday too. So I'm not going to pass my mother up for Sonny Chiba, you know, despite how much I love him.
You are a dedicated son, my friend. That is a good choice right there.
Yeah, even if Sonny Chiba turns into a werewolf.
Ooh, that does make it a tougher choice, though.
In any case, I do own the Blu-ray, so maybe I'll just watch it myself.
All right, well, let's wrap this up. For all those people who are listening out there, we are going to be doing John Carpenter's The Thing from 1982 for our next episode, so make sure you rewatch that so that you can join the conversation. Miss Chelsea, where can people find you on the internet? Give me your Twitter handle.
I don't use Twitter. I don't even know what
it
is.
If they start adding you, you'll get notifications.
I don't even know what my Twitter handle is.
Okay, well.
I'm on Instagram sometimes. at Concocted Reality, but I don't use Twitter. I don't really use it. Okay. Sorry.
You don't have to be sorry. Mr. Cesar, at Junior Bijo on Twitter, right?
Yes, that's correct.
And then you can find all of your reviews at filmsmash.com.
That is also correct.
Yes. And for myself, you can find me on Twitter at Setting the Frame. And every week here at Celluloid Jelly. So until next time, we'll see you guys later. Thanks, Cesar.
Thanks, guys.
Bye.
Celluloid Jelly was recorded using Google Hangouts, mixed using Apple's GarageBand software, and hosted by Podbean. For any inquiries related to Celluloid Jelly, please email settingtheframe@gmail.com.